Hello, I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly's review of 2008. On this end-of-year special podcast, it's been a good year. We didn't split the atom or perfect nuclear fusion, but we did manage to break the world's biggest experiment.
I feel as if we are ending a marathon with a sprint. The pressure has always been high on the LHC, but over the last year, and especially over the last few months, to meet the deadline has been enormous. But we're all still on our feet, and we're really looking forward now to bringing the machine into operation.
Can you imagine how much trouble you'd get into at school if you did that? We took you on holiday with us to Massachusetts and Merseyside.
One is hibiscus sorbet, or actually hibiscus tea sorbet.
That sounds good.
The other flavour I brought over is wort.
Science is interesting and you can learn lots of different things.
I think science is fun and interesting.
Explosives, building stuff.
I think science is really good fun because I like doing experiments.
Science is very interesting. It makes me think about lasers.
Plus, wobbling, space, stem cells. We even gave you a guide on how to build your own spaceship. Oh yeah, and we found a G-spot.
Yes! Yes!
Just one of our happy listeners there. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. If you've never heard The Guardian Science Weekly podcast, this is the concept behind it. A recipe, if you like. Get some science, add a special guest, wrap it up in debate, sprinkle a bit of jokey nonsense, and then nibble on it. Or download it or something. Yummy. You're now going to try and hear us try to squeeze in this year's highlights into half an hour. It's like compacting mass into a black hole or something. Throughout, you'll be hearing bits from me, Alok Jha, as well as science correspondents Ian Sample and James Randerson. So let's go back, way back, to arguably the biggest science story of the year, the Large Hadron Collider. So important, in fact, we dedicated a whole podcast to it in its honour back in June, the CERNcast.
My name is Lawrence Krauss. I'm the Ambrose Swayze Professor of Physics, Professor of Astronomy, and Director of the Center for Education and Research in Cosmology and Astrophysics at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. It'll probably take a year or two before the first physics results come out of CERN. And I don't know what'll happen. You act as if that's a bad thing. And it's not. I mean, what keeps us going in some sense except for our constant wondering about the universe? And that's true not just for science, but for art and literature. We want to ask questions about ourselves. We want to get new insights. And nature has always surprised us whenever we open a new window. And so, yeah, if we're right completely about all of our theoretical ideas, then in the first year or two, we'll see the Higgs particle, and maybe we'll see something called supersymmetry, and we'll be on a merry way to understand a great deal about nature.
Of course, we were there when it was switched on too. Another special podcast was commissioned.
A particle that is thought to explain the origin of mass in the universe. The particle is named after the Scottish physicist Peter Higgs, who couldn't make the big switch on, but spoke to our correspondent Severin Carell in Edinburgh.
I don't like the description God particle at all, if you're thinking of that.
No.
I think it's inappropriate. On theological grounds, apart from anything else. That from a non-religious person.
Were you at home this morning when the broadcast from CERN was coming through?
That was at 8:30, was it? I mean, I must have been at home, but I hardly ever listened to the radio anyway, so I wasn't listening. I was too busy getting myself ready to come here, and I probably wasn't even completely awake by then. And normally I'm not completely conscious until after breakfast.
But then Ian's prediction from the preview of 2008 came true. Yes, it broke. Rather than another programme in its honour, we just had a quick laugh about it.
And exactly, didn't it? People in pubs across the land were saying, oh, this could be our last night out.
It's been incredible. And I think no scientist thought that it would capture the imagination like it has done. I think it's actually not a bad thing at all.
And the minute we know the date for it being revved up again, you'll find the details at guardian.co.uk/science/CERN.
Science Weekly.
For someone out there, this may be the first podcast you listen to on your shiny new generic MP3 player. To make sure you keep getting this entertaining listen, make sure you're subscribed to our feed so you never miss out on the latest edition, out every Monday morning. Here in the Science Weekly Pod, we're never afraid to tackle the big issues. Just hours after Barack Obama was elected the next US president, we generated reaction from the scientific community on both sides of the Atlantic.
We are excited about Barack Obama being the next president of the United States. George Bush was not good for science, and he was not good for evidence-based policy. He left several of the scientific advisory positions left unfilled. He ignored evidence-based advice, and this all resulted in poor policy decisions, and at the end of the day, a lot of scientists left government. So we're excited about a change in that respect.
Well, I'm sure they'll do that. And also, one final thing, which one is sure that Obama will prioritize more than Bush, and that is trying to achieve the Millennium Development Goals for Africa and the rest of the world, because it's really depressing that the UN target of 0.7% of GNP being used for overseas aid is not being met in most countries, and the country that falls short by the biggest factor is the United States, and that's really disgraceful, and I really hope that he will change that.
Martin Rees there. And while we're on about special podcasts, do you remember the one about music and the brain?
There's a quote of Mendelssohn's where he famously said that music is too precise to express in words. And that seems to me to be a clarion call of what music almost certainly is. And if it is, then the call then is to discover what is it that's being described.
Now, we like our listeners so much, we never go anywhere without them. So back in February, we packed our bags for the world's biggest science gathering, the AAAS conference in Boston, and set up our ASCAS studio in, where else, an ice cream parlour.
Students here. Can I ask you, you've hung out with a lot of these scientists for a long time, you've been to their labs, you've seen some interesting things, but have any of these scientists come up with a cure for brain freeze?
No.
So you still get brain freeze when you eat ice cream a bit too quickly?
I don't.
Do you get it?
The other night at the Ignoble events, someone was talking about the holy grail of this field and the holy grail of that field, and it would seem that in ice cream science, the holy grail, the great unsolved problem, is brain freeze.
This is it. If you've got any solutions,
probably some sort of Manhattan Project will be required to solve that.
Send your ideas in.
And when the conference's British equivalent started oozing science, we were there with our microphones in Liverpool.
Same thermal hang threshold, 47 degrees, your power outage.
Can you explain the Swedish nurse phenomena?
The back of his hand was being stroked by his partner or by a control person. And the hands were equilibrated for temperature, so the hand didn't feel cold. So basically, the back of his hand was being stroked. And he knew in which situation who the stroker was. So a familiar person, if you like, was touching him, his wife, and then the control toucher to expose that social context. And that's where the brain area that we would have predicted would be activated by the pleasant affective aspects of that touch was activated more by the stranger than by the wife.
And she was
attractive.
Yes.
And we did tell him and her.
By the way, all the snippets you hear in this programme are available to listen in full. Our archive is there forever, or at least until the internet is switched off. Go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. As you can imagine, science celebrities are desperate to appear on this show.
Hi, I'm Robert Winston. I'm Professor of Science and Society at Imperial College, a new chair. And this is the Guardian podcast.
Hi, this is Katie Tunstall, and this is probably the only time I will ever say you're listening to the science podcast from guardian.co.uk.
Not sure about the second one there. But anyway, we've had some cracking interviews over the last 12 months. We've asked mathematician Marcus de Sautoy whether he's nervous about taking over from Richard Dawkins as the Simonu Chair for the Public Understanding of Science at the University of Oxford.
No, I am bracing myself, of course, for everyone asking me whether I believe in God or not.
Do you believe in God?
No, I'm an atheist, and I think... But For me, actually, the important thing is the wonder of science. And I think you put your finger on it exactly. There's so much exciting things to talk about science. I mean, I understand Richard's point. There are great fears about the power of the intelligent design movement in America. But my focus is really on trying to excite people about science, why I do it, why a lot of people do it, how it impacts on your life. It's very important to our whole society. Society is knocking up again and again against issues of science. And it's important that they have a grasp of what's going on to be able to make decisions. So my focus is going to be very much on the science and less on religion.
American space tourist Richard Garriott told Ian Sample what it's like to be blasted into space in a Soyuz capsule and then crash back to Earth.
And right after that, you begin to encounter the atmosphere. You begin to see plasma build up outside the windows, basically fire going by outside the windows. The heat shield begins to ablate. It looks like Roman candles or sparklers going off outside the window. You see bits of tinfoil and other things that are all melting off the side of the capsule that begins to blacken the outside of those windows. And in fact, before the parachutes open, the windows basically become covered with soot.
Right.
In fact, as the thrusters are continuing to orient the capsule, that also seems to be what adds to this blackening on the windows. And then you get to the altitude where the parachutes open. And the parachute deployment is a fairly raucous event. I mean, it's like you're on the end of a whip that's being cracked. And so things get violently, anything's not strapped down is going to get tossed around once inside the space capsule. And shortly thereafter, the heat shields are dropped, which also ejects the outer pane of glass that's been blackened. And so you actually get a chance to see again the view. At this point, you're already well within the atmosphere. Couldn't see the parachutes, but you could see that now I'm at least now within the atmosphere. And we landed almost precisely, or we came in really right on target. So the helicopters were right there, had us in sight, gave us the countdown from a few kilometers up and told us how we were approaching the ground. So we knew when we were getting ready to touch down. They don't like to use the word impact, but I would describe it also as an impact. The final actual touchdown, you're in about a 6-ton, metal object below this gigantic parachute. And when it encounters the ground at what, I don't actually remember the speed, but it feels like about a 30-mile-an-hour car crash. And, so it's a very hard, very violent strike. And you kind of bounce and roll for almost 30 seconds exactly.
And one of our most downloaded podcasts this year, author of the Bad Science column in The Guardian, Ben Goldacre, and his controlled rant against the media.
As you might expect, I have to say I completely disagree that you shouldn't put science in the news pages of a newspaper. I mean, it seems to me an absurd suggestion, because what you're advocating is taking out a massive source of information about science from people who would never see it otherwise. So the entire population would be denuded of information about science and what's going on in science. Apart from the fact that a lot of them might be very interested in it, they've paid for it, by and large, mostly, and they have a right to know about it. You're right that there is a certain proportion of stories that are badly reported. But I think to attack news coverage in general because of that is a straw man.
I'm not suggesting that there should be no science news reporting, but I think that the sacrifices that are made, more so in other newspapers than in this one, to crowbar a science story into the news format are very, very significant. In a feature, you have the opportunity to expand on things and also talk about background. I mean, one of the biggest problems in communicating science clearly to a motivated lay audience, because that's the problem. It's not the problem isn't that people are clever or stupid, it's just that they're lacking background knowledge and they're lacking interest. The problem with communicating science to a motivated lay audience is usually that they don't have the background knowledge. And I think in news, you've got less of a chance of filling them in on the background than you do in features. But it's not an absolute. I'm not saying there should be no science news. That would be clearly preposterous.
Science Weekly. From Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
You know, it's not all about quarks, stem cells and turning low-grade sludge into high-value hydrogen gas. We occasionally, regularly, indulge in the more jovial scientific breakthroughs. We told you about how to build a spaceship.
But actually, there were aerospace or aeroplane designers as early as the 1930s and 1940s proposing that the way to get into space was to carry the spaceship part on top of a large winged glider or winged carrier plane. That was the most efficient way of doing it. When you fire like a Saturn moon rocket, just picture in your mind's eye the moment of ignition. You've got thousands of tons of machinery sitting there inert on the launch pad, and you've got all that sound and fury and energy simply devoted to getting it that first inch off the ground. That seems like an inelegant approach. It has worked. It's wonderful. It's one of the great, in many ways, crowning achievements of human civilization, those rockets. But it's time to move on. It's time to get the obvious business of just getting off the ground done more efficiently and elegantly.
We analyzed the science of wobbling. So we're walking up to see the architectural jellies now, going between the jelly dancers with their massive spoons. They must be freezing. I'm not sure what we're going to see when we get up here. It's quite a throng in amongst the pillars of UCL Quad. People all around eating jellies like there's no tomorrow. Oh, and here are the architectural jellies. There's St. Paul's Cathedral there. There's the Eden Project jelly. There's what looks like the Taj Mahal, I think. Blimey. They're all like blobs of pink wobbling away. The world was introduced to the scientific chuckle brothers, James and producer Andy.
Okay, party shirts, laptop.
Yeah, I've got a couple of microphones.
Test tubes?
Yeah, I've got my Bunsen burner, you don't need to bring yours.
All right, okay, I'll leave that. Small Hadron Collider?
Check.
Okay, where are my... there they are, socks. Yes, okay. Beards?
Check.
Okay, you got your cord jacket, Andy?
Yep, and with freshly sewn-on patches on the elbows.
Flying reindeer's balderdash. If you look at the muscle and bone structure of the animal, I think you'll find that it simply cannot generate enough propulsion. Plus, hello, no wings. Oh, and don't get me started on the aerodynamics.
Now, even if we assume the flying reindeer, there's the preposterous notion of Santa visiting all the children in the world.
No, quite so.
Now, let's assume 1 billion households in 24 hours. That's roughly 11,000 a second. Now, let's not beat around the bush here. That sleigh's travelling faster than the speed of light, which means that Rudolph is going to have to cope with more than just a red nose. He's going to be increasing to infinite mass.
Oh, yes, and what about that quaint Jesus story? I mean, do they really expect us to believe that Mary was a virgin?
Yes, I can think of a few more parsimonious explanations for
that. Oh, and whilst we're showcasing the delights of Science Weekly, why don't you join our fine team of loyal listeners? Sign up to our Facebook group, free, of course. It's called I Listen to the Guardian Science Podcast. You can then add comments and converse with like-minded grown-ups. Possibly the most significant news of 2008, Ian found the G-spot. The outtakes for this recording are worth a show on its own. On to something a bit more positive, G-spots. Ian, I don't know how to ask this question, but where is the G-spot?
Well, I mean, I'm the last person to ask, really. But what's fascinating is this this Italian doctor, Emanuele Giannini, was paid to give ultrasound scans to about 20 women, half of whom had immensely enjoyable vaginal orgasms, the other half didn't. And he looked at the differences in their vaginal anatomy. And this is obviously in the sort of the cavity, let's call it. And he found that there was a lot thicker tissue between the vaginal wall and the urethra in the women who had vaginal orgasms, suggesting that might be where a G-spot is, infused with blood vessels and the like and all that. And the women who didn't. And it's funny, it sort of plays on from some research he did a while ago. He's a kind of a G-spot meister. This isn't the first study he's done on G-spots. He found previously that this section of skin in women who have these sort of intense responses produce more markers, chemical markers of things, one of them being an enzyme that processes nitric oxide, which is by chance the same chemical that gives men erections.
So women can take Viagra as well, perhaps?
Women do take Viagra.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Well, because that stimulates the release of nitric oxide, doesn't it?
Is that why?
That's exactly why. That's exactly why men need it. Do men have G-spots? Do you know?
Well, I don't know, because what's intriguing about this story, and it's all, you know, completely enlightening for me, is that there are apparently for women two different types of orgasm. There's sort of clitoral orgasm and vaginal orgasm. What's, you know, some people say, well, this might just be not be a G-spot. It might just be an extension of the clitoris. It might just sort of, you know, go in a bit further than we thought on some women. Whether men have different varieties of orgasms, I don't know. How do we rank this? I mean, we need to sort of pull our thoughts and rank things.
No, I don't think that's a discussion.
We need a scientific study.
That's not a discussion for radio. It really isn't. And
you started it.
Well, I think we all need a cold shower and a lie down after that. And finally, before we close this scientific equivalent to the Beano Annual, let's take a moment to reflect on those who can't be with us at this time of year. On November the 17th, we said goodbye to NASA's Phoenix lander. Tissues at the ready, everyone.
T-minus 10, 9... 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Main engine start. 2, 1, 0. And liftoff of the Delta II rocket with Phoenix, a distant science outpost seeking clues of the evolution at the polar region of Mars.
The vehicle is responding.
And finally, a tribute to a science great. Phoenix, the Mars lander, has gone to the big experiment in the sky.
The team has me on extreme, bed rest to recharge power supply. There is cautious optimism about pulling out of this in a few days.
The plucky robot blasted off from Earth last year and landed on Mars this May.
In case we don't get this chance again, thank you all so much for the questions, comments and good wishes over the mission. It's been awesome.
It's been keeping everyone updated on its progress throughout by little text messages or tweets.
I'm resting a lot, but still communicating with orbiters once per day. Still hoping to get a bit of strength back and maybe do more science.
But alas, it's twittering no more. The bitter Martian chill has finally brought it to the end of its mission, having almost doubled its planned operational life of 3 months.
It's very unlikely I'll wake up next spring, but if I do, I'll call home.
That was one of the last messages from Mars rover Phoenix. So what can we expect for the next 12 months? The one big question, of course, can they find sticky tape strong enough to help put CERN's Large Hadron Collider back together? Next week, we've got another Science Weekly special for you. It's a guided tour around the Guardian's new super green headquarters in London. We'll be looking at some of the technology employed in helping pioneer this new sustainable building. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jar. And if you've forgotten to get that special someone a gift this Christmas, get them the present money simply can't buy. Well, that's because it's free. A lifetime subscription to Science Weekly. Guardian.co.uk/Science Weekly.